I decided to share this unfortunate information with you for three reasons. First, to show you Zach Herney is a decent man who considers the government's well-being before his personal gain. Second, to inform you that your candidate is not as trustworthy as you might think. And third, to persuade you to accept the offer I am about to make. That offer being, I'd like to offer you a chance to do the right thing. The patriotic thing. Whether you know it or not, you are in a unique position to spare Washington all kinds of unpleasant scandal. If you can do what I am about to ask, perhaps you could even earn yourself a place on the president's team. A place on the president's team? Gabrielle couldn't believe what she was hearing. Miss Tench, whatever you have in mind, I do not appreciate being blackmailed, coerced, or talked down to. I work for the senator's campaign because I believe in his politics. And if this is any indication of the way Zach Herney exerts political influence, I have no interest in being associated with him. If you've got something on Senator Sexton, then I suggest you leak it to the press. Frankly, I think this whole thing's a sham. Tench gave a dreary sigh. Gabrielle, your candidate's illegal funding is a fact. I'm sorry. I know you trust him. She lowered her voice. Look, here's the point. The president and I will go public with the funding issue if we must. But it will get ugly on a grand scale. This scandal involves several major U.S. corporations breaking the law. A lot of innocent people will pay the price. She took a long drag and exhaled. What the president and I are hoping for here is some other way to discredit the senator's ethics. A way that is more contained. One in which no innocent parties get hurt. Tench set down her cigarette and folded her hands. Simply put, we would like you to publicly admit that you had an affair with the senator. Gabrielle's entire body went rigid. Tench sounded utterly certain of herself. Impossible, Gabrielle knew. There was no proof. The sex had happened only once, behind locked doors, in Sexton's senatorial office. Tench has nothing. She's fishing. Gabrielle fought to retain her steady tone. You assume a lot, Miss Tench. Which? That you had an affair? Or that you would abandon your candidate? Both. Tench gave a curt smile and stood up. Well, let's put one of those facts to rest right now, shall we? She walked to her wall safe again and returned with a red manila folder. It was stamped with the White House seal. She unhooked the clasp, tipped the envelope over, and dumped the contents out on the desk in front of Gabrielle. As dozens of color photographs spilled out onto the desk, Gabrielle saw her entire career come crashing down before her. Chapter 46. Outside the Habosphere, the katabatic wind roaring down off the glacier was nothing like the ocean winds Tallon was accustomed to. On the ocean, wind was a function of tides and pressure fronts, and came in gusting ebbs and flows. The katabatic, however, was a slave to simple physics, heavy, cold air rushing down a glacial incline like a tidal wave. It was the most resolute gale force Tallon had ever experienced. Had it been coming at 20 knots, the katabatic would have been a sailor's dream. But at its current 80 knots, it could quickly become a nightmare, even for those on solid ground. Tallon found that if he paused and leaned backward, the stalwart squall could easily prop him up. Making the raging river of air even more unnerving to Tallon was the slight downward grade of the ice shelf. The ice was sloped ever so slightly toward the ocean, 2 miles away. Despite the sharp spikes on the pit bull rapido crampons attached to his boots, Tallon had the uneasy feeling that any misstep might leave him caught up in a gale and sliding down the endless icy slope. Nora Manger's 2-minute course in glacier safety now seemed dangerously inadequate. Piranha Ice Axe, Nora had said, fastening a lightweight T-shaped tool to each of their belts as they suited up in the habosphere. Standard blade, banana blade, semi-tubular blade, hammer, and adze. All you need to remember is if anyone slips or gets caught up in a gust, grab your axe with one hand on the head and one on the shaft, ram the banana blade into the ice, and fall on it, planting your crampons. With those words of assurance, Nora Manger had affixed yak belay harnesses to each of them. They all donned goggles and headed out into the afternoon darkness. Now the four figures made their way down the glacier in a straight line with 10 yards of belay rope separating each of them. Nora was in the lead position, followed by Corky, then Rachel, and Tolland as anchor. As they moved farther away from the habosphere, Tolland felt a growing uneasiness. In his inflated suit, although warm, he felt like some kind of uncoordinated space traveler trekking across a distant planet. The moon had disappeared behind thick, billowing storm clouds, plunging the ice sheet into an impenetrable blackness. The katabatic wind seemed to be getting stronger by the minute, applying a constant pressure to Tolland's back. As his eyes strained through his goggles to make out the expansive emptiness around them, he began to perceive a true danger in this place. Redundant NASA safety precautions or not, Tolland was surprised the administrator had been willing to risk 4 lives out here instead of 2. Especially when the additional 2 lives were that of a senator's daughter and a famous astrophysicist. Tolland wasn't surprised to feel a protective concern for Rachel and Corky. As someone who had captained a ship, he was used to feeling responsible for those around him. "Stay behind me!" Nora shouted, her voice swallowed by the wind. "Let the sled lead the way!" The aluminum sled on which Nora was transporting her testing gear resembled an oversized, flexible flyer. The craft was pre-packed with diagnostic gear and safety accessories she'd been using on the glacier over the past few days. All of her gear, including a battery pack, safety flares, and a powerful front-mounted spotlight, was bound under a secured plastic tarp. Despite the heavy load, the sled glided effortlessly on long, straight runners. Even on the most imperceptible incline, the sled moved downhill on its own accord, and Nora applied a gentle restraint, almost as if allowing the sled to lead the way. Sensing the distance growing between the group and the habosphere, Tolland looked over his shoulder. Only 50 yards away, the pale curvature of the dome had all but disappeared in the blustery blackness. "You were all worried about finding our way back?" Tolland yelled. "The habosphere was almost His words were cut short by the loud hiss of a flare igniting in Nora's hand. The sudden red-white glow illuminated the ice shelf in a 10-yard radius all around them. Nora used her heel to dig a small impression in the surface snow, piling up a protective ridge on the upwind side of the hole. Then she rammed the flare into the indentation. "High-tech breadcrumbs!" Nora shouted.
"Breadcrumbs?" Rachel asked, shielding her eyes from the sudden light.
"Hansel and Gretel," Nora shouted. "These flares will last an hour. Plenty of time to find our way back."
With that, Nora headed out again, leading them down the glacier, into the darkness once again. Chapter 47. Gabrielle Ash stormed out of Marjorie Tench's office and practically knocked over a secretary in doing so. Mortified, all Gabrielle could see were the photographs, images, arms and legs intertwined, faces filled with ecstasy. Gabrielle had no idea how the photos had been taken, but she knew damn well they were real. They had been taken in Senator Sexton's office and seemed to have been shot from above, as if by hidden camera.
"God help me."
One of the photos showed Gabrielle and Sexton having sex directly on top of the senator's desk, their bodies sprawled across a scatter of official-looking documents. Marjorie Tench caught up with Gabrielle outside the map room. Tench was carrying the red envelope of photos.
"I assume from your reaction that you believe these photos are authentic."
The president's senior advisor actually looked like she was having a good time.
I am hoping they persuade you that our other data is accurate as well. They came from the same source.
Gabrielle felt her entire body flushing as she marched down the hall. Where the hell is the exit? Tensha's gangly legs had no trouble keeping up.
Senator Sexton swore to the world that you two are platonic associates. His televised statement was actually quite convincing.
Tench motioned smugly over her shoulder.
In fact, I have a tape in my office if you'd like to refresh your memory.
Gabrielle needed no refresher. She remembered the press conference all too well. Sexton's denial was as adamant as it was heartfelt.
It's unfortunate, Tench said, sounding not at all disappointed. But Senator Sexton looked the American people in the eye and told a bald-faced lie. The public has a right to know, and they will know. I'll see to it personally. The only question now is how the public finds out. We believe it's best coming from you.
Gabrielle was stunned.
You really think I'm going to help lynch my own candidate?
Tench's face hardened.
I'm trying to take the high ground here, Gabrielle. I'm giving you a chance to save everyone a lot of embarrassment by holding your head high and telling the truth. All I need is a signed statement admitting your affair.
Gabrielle stopped short.
What?
Of course. A signed statement gives us the leverage we need to deal with the senator quietly, sparing the country this ugly mess. My offer is simple. Sign a statement for me, and these photos never need to see the light of day.
You want a statement?
Technically, I would need an affidavit, but we have a notary here in the building who could...
You're crazy!
Gabrielle was walking again. Tench stayed at her side, sounding more angry now.
Senator Sexton is going down one way or another, Gabrielle, and I'm offering you a chance to get out of this without seeing your own naked ass in the morning paper. The president is a decent man and doesn't want these photos publicized. If you just give me an affidavit and confess to the affair on your own terms, then all of us can retain a little dignity.
I'm not for sale.
Well, your candidate certainly is. He's a dangerous man, and he's breaking the law.
He's breaking the law? You're the ones breaking into offices and taking illegal surveillance pictures? Ever heard of Watergate?
We had nothing to do with gathering this dirt. These photos came from the same source as the SFF campaign funding information. Someone's been watching you two very closely.
Gabrielle tore past the security desk, where she had gotten her security badge. She ripped off the badge and tossed it to the wide-eyed guard. Tench was still on her tail.
You'll need to decide fast, Miss Ash,
Tench said as they neared the exit.
Either bring me an affidavit admitting you slept with the senator, or at 8 o'clock tonight, the president will be forced to go public with everything. Sexton's financial dealings, the photos of you, the works. And believe me, when the public sees that you stood idly by and let Sexton lie about your relationship, you'll go down in flames right beside him.
Gabrielle saw the door and headed for it.
On my desk by 8 o'clock tonight, Gabrielle. Be smart.
Tench tossed her the folder of photographs on her way out.
Keep them, sweetie. We've got plenty more.
Chapter 48. Rachel Sexton felt a growing chill inside as she moved down the ice sheet into the deepening night. Disquieting images swirled in her mind. The meteorite, the phosphorescent plankton, the implications if Nora Manger had made a mistake with the ice cores. A solid matrix of freshwater ice, Nora had argued, reminding them all that she had drilled cores all around the area, as well as directly over the meteorite. If the glacier contained saltwater interstices filled with plankton, she would have seen them, wouldn't she? Nonetheless, Rachel's intuition kept returning to the simplest solution. There are plankton frozen in this glacier. 10 minutes and 4 flares later, Rachel and the others were approximately 250 yards from the habosphere. Without warning, Nora stopped short.
"This is the spot," she said,
sounding like a water witch diviner who had mystically sensed the perfect spot to drill a well. Rachel turned and glanced up the slope behind them. The Habosphere had long since disappeared into the dim, moonlit night, but the line of flares was clearly visible, the farthest one twinkling reassuringly like a faint star. The flares were in a perfect straight line, like a carefully calculated runway. Rachel was impressed with Nora's skills.
"Another reason we let the sled go first,"
Nora called out when she saw Rachel admiring the line of flares.
"The runners are straight. If we let gravity lead the sled and we don't interfere, we're guaranteed to travel in a straight line."
"Neat trick," Tolan yelled. "Wish there was something like that for the open sea."
This is the open sea, Rachel thought, picturing the ocean beneath them.
For a split second, the most distant flame caught her attention. It had disappeared, as if the light had been blotted out by a passing form. A moment later, though, the light reappeared. Rachel felt a sudden uneasiness.
"Nora,"
she yelled over the wind,
"did you say there were polar bears up here?"
The glaciologist was preparing a final flare, and either didn't hear or was ignoring her.
"Polar bears," Tolland yelled, "eat seals. They only attack human beings when we invade their space."
"But this is polar bear country, right?"
Rachel could never remember which pole had bears and which had penguins.
"Yeah," Tolland shouted back. "Polar bears actually give the Arctic its name. Arctos is Greek for bear."
"Terrific."
Rachel gazed nervously into the dark.
"Antarctica has no polar bears," Tolland said, "so they call it Anti-Arctos."
"Thanks, Mike," Rachel yelled. "Enough talk of polar bears."
He laughed.
"Right. Sorry."
Nora pressed a final flare into the snow. As before, the four of them were engulfed in a reddish glow, looking bloated in their black weather suits. Beyond the circle of light emanating from the flare, the rest of the world became totally invisible, a circular shroud of blackness engulfing them. As Rachel and the others looked on, Nora planted her feet and used careful overhand motions to reel the sled several yards back up the slope to where they were standing. Then, keeping the rope taut, she crouched and manually activated the sled's talon brakes, four angled spikes that dug into the ice to keep the sled stationary. That done, she stood up and brushed herself off, the rope around her waist falling slack.
"All right," Nora shouted. "Time to go to work."
The glaciologist circled to the downwind end of the sled and began unfastening the butterfly eyelets holding the protective canvas over the gear. Rachel, feeling like she had been a little hard on Nora, moved to help by unfastening the rear of the flap.
"Jesus, no!" Nora yelled, her head snapping up. "Don't ever do that!"
Rachel recoiled, confused.
"Never unfasten the upwind side," Nora said. "You'll create a windsock. This sled would have taken off like an umbrella in a wind tunnel."
Rachel backed off.
"I'm sorry, I..."
She glared.
"You and Space Boy shouldn't be out here."
"None of us should," Rachel thought. "Amateurs,"
Nora seethed, cursing the administrator's insistence on sending Corky and Sexton along.
"These clowns are going to get someone killed out here."
The last thing Nora wanted right now was to play babysitter.
"Mike," she said, "I need help lifting the GPR off the sled."
Tolan helped her unpack the ground-penetrating radar and position it on the ice. The instrument looked like three miniature snowplow blades that had been affixed in parallel to an aluminum frame. The entire device was no more than a yard long and was connected by cables to a current attenuator and a marine battery on the sled.
"That's radar?"
Corky asked, yelling over the wind. Nora nodded in silence. Ground-penetrating radar was far more equipped to see brine ice than Pod's was. The GPR transmitter sent pulses of electromagnetic energy through the ice, and the pulses bounced differently off substances of differing crystal structure. Pure freshwater froze in a flat shingled lattice. However, seawater froze in more of a meshed or forked lattice on account of its sodium content, causing the GPR pulses to bounce back erratically, greatly diminishing the number of reflections. Nora powered up the machine.
I'll be taking a kind of echolocation cross-sectional image of the ice sheet around the extraction pit, she yelled. The machine's internal software will render a cross-section of the glacier and then print it out. Any sea ice will register as a shadow.
Print out? Tallon looked surprised. You can print out here? Nora pointed to a cable from the GPR leading to a device still protected under the canopy.
No choice but to print. Computer screens use too much valuable battery power, so field glaciologists print data to heat transfer printers. Colors aren't brilliant, but laser toner clumps below neg 20. Learned that the hard way in Alaska.
Nora asked everyone to stand on the downhill side of the GPR as she prepared to align the transmitter such that it would scan the area of the meteorite hole, almost 3 football fields away. But as Nora looked back through the night in the general direction from which they had come, she couldn't see a damn thing.
Mike, I need to align the GPR transmitter with the meteorite site, but this flare has me blinded. I'm going back up the slope just enough to get out of the light. I'll hold my arms in line with the flares, and you adjust the alignment on the GPR.
Tallon nodded, kneeling down beside the radar device. Nora stamped her crampons into the ice and leaned forward against the wind as she moved up the incline toward the habosphere. The katabatic today was much stronger than she'd imagined, and she sensed a storm coming in. It didn't matter, they would be done here in a matter of minutes.
They'll see I'm right.
Nora clomped 20 yards back toward the habosphere. She reached the edge of the darkness just as the belay rope went taut. Nora looked back up the glacier. As her eyes adjusted to the dark, the line of flares slowly came into view several degrees to her left. She shifted her position until she was perfectly lined up with them. Then she held her arms out like a compass, turning her body, indicating the exact vector.
"I'm in line with them now," she yelled.
Tallon adjusted the GPR device and waved.
All set.
Nora took a final look up the incline, grateful for the illuminated pathway home. As she looked out, though, something odd occurred. For an instant, one of the nearest flares entirely disappeared from view. Before Nora could worry that it was dying out, the flame reappeared. If Nora didn't know better, she would assume something had passed between the flare and her location. Certainly nobody else was out here. Unless, of course, the administrator had started to feel guilty and sent a NASA team out after them. Somehow Nora doubted it. Probably nothing, she decided. A gust of wind had momentarily killed the flame. Nora returned to the GPR.
All lined up?
Tallon shrugged.
I think so.
Nora went over to the control device on the sled and pressed a button. A sharp buzz emanated from the GPR and then stopped.
Okay, she said. Done.
That's it?
Corky said.
All the work is in setup. The actual shot takes only a second.
On board the sled, the heat transfer printer had already begun to hum and click. The printer was enclosed in a clear plastic covering and was slowly ejecting a heavy, curled paper. Nora waited until the device had completed printing, and then she reached up under the plastic and removed the printout.
They'll see, she thought,
carrying the printout over to the flare so that everyone could see it.
There won't be any salt water.
Everyone gathered around as Nora stood over the flare, clutching the printout tightly in her gloves. She took a deep breath and uncurled the paper to examine the data. The image on the paper made her recoil in horror.
Oh, God!
Nora stared, unable to believe what she was looking at. As expected, the printout revealed a clear cross-section of the water-filled meteorite shaft. But what Nora had never expected to see was the hazy, grayish outline of a humanoid form floating halfway down the shaft. Her blood turned to ice.
Oh, God! There's a body in the extraction pit!
Everyone stared in stunned silence. The ghost-like body was floating head down in the narrow shaft. Billowing around the corpse like some sort of cape was an eerie, shroud-like aura. Nora now realized what the aura was. The GPR had captured a faint trace of the victim's heavy coat, what could only be a familiar, long, dense camel hair.
It's
Ming, she said in a whisper. He must have slipped. Nora Manger never imagined that seeing Ming's body in the extraction pit would be the lesser of the two shocks the printout would reveal. But as her eyes traced downward in the shaft, she saw something else. The ice beneath the extraction shaft. Nora stared. Her first thought was that something had gone wrong with the scan. Then, as she studied the image more closely, an unsettling realization began to grow, like the storm gathering around them. The paper's edges flapped wildly in the wind as she turned and looked more intently at the printout.
But that's impossible.
Suddenly the truth came crashing down. The realization felt like it was going to bury her. She forgot all about Ming. Nora now understood. The salt water in the shaft. She fell to her knees in the snow beside the flare. She could barely breathe. Still clutching the paper in her hand, she began trembling.
My God, it didn't even occur to me.
Then, with a sudden eruption of rage, she spun her head in the direction of the NASA habosphere.
You bastards!
She screamed, her voice trailing off in the wind.
You goddamn bastards!
In the darkness, only 50 yards away, Delta One held his Kryptalk device to his mouth and spoke only 2 words to his controller. They know. Chapter 49. Nora Manger was still kneeling on the ice when the bewildered Michael Tollan pulled the ground-penetrating radar's printout from her trembling hands. Shaken from seeing the floating body of Ming, Tollan tried to gather his thoughts and decipher the image before him. He saw the cross-section of the meteorite shaft descending from the surface down to 200 feet into the ice. He saw Ming's body floating in the shaft. Tollan's eyes drifted lower now, and he sensed something was amiss. Directly beneath the extraction shaft, a dark column of sea ice extended downward to the open ocean below. The vertical pillar of saltwater ice was massive, the same diameter as the shaft.
My God! Rachel yelled, looking over Tollan's shoulder. It looks like the meteorite shaft continues all the way through the ice shelf into the ocean.
Tollan stood transfixed, his brain unable to accept what he knew to be the only logical explanation. Corky looked equally alarmed.
Norris shouted, Someone drilled up under the shelf!
Her eyes were wild with rage.
Someone intentionally inserted that rock from underneath the ice.
Although the idealist in Tollan wanted to reject Nora's words, the scientist in him knew she could easily be right. The Milne ice shelf was floating over the ocean with plenty of clearance for a submersible. Because everything weighed significantly less underwater, even a small submersible, not much bigger than Tollan's one-man research Triton, easily could have transported the meteorite in its payload arms. The sub could have approached from the ocean, submerged beneath the ice shelf, and drilled upward into the ice. Then it could have used an extending payload arm or inflatable balloons to push the meteorite up into the shaft. Once the meteorite was in place, the ocean water that had risen into the shaft behind the meteorite would begin to freeze. As soon as the shaft closed enough to hold the meteorite in place, the sub could retract its arm and disappear, leaving Mother Nature to seal the remainder of the tunnel and erase all traces of the deception.
But why?
Rachel demanded, taking the printout from Tollan and studying it.
Why would someone do that? Are you sure your GPR is working? Of course I'm sure. And the printout perfectly explains the presence of phosphorescent bacteria in the water.
Tollan had to admit Nora's logic was chillingly sound. Phosphorescent dinoflagellates would have followed instinct and swum upward into the meteorite shaft, becoming trapped just beneath the meteorite and freezing into the ice. Later, when Nora heated the meteorite, the ice directly beneath would have melted, releasing the plankton. Again, they would swim upward, this time reaching the surface inside the habosphere, where they would eventually die for lack of salt water.
This is crazy, Corky yelled.
NASA has a meteorite with extraterrestrial fossils in it. Why would they care where it's found? Why would they go to the trouble to bury it under an ice shelf?
Who the hell knows? Nora fired back. But GPR printouts don't lie. We were tricked. That meteorite isn't part of the Jungasaw Fall. It was inserted in the ice recently, within the last year, or the plankton would be dead.
She was already packing up her GPR gear on the sled and fastening it down.
We have to get back and tell someone. The president is about to go public with all the wrong data. NASA tricked him.
Wait a minute, Rachel yelled. We should at least run another scan to make sure. None of this makes sense. Who will believe it?
Everyone, Nora said, preparing her sled. When I march into the Habosphere and drill another core sample out of the bottom of the meteorite shaft and it comes up as saltwater ice, I guarantee you everyone will believe this.
Nora disengaged the brakes on the equipment sled, redirected it toward the Habosphere, and started back up the slope, digging her crampons into the ice and pulling the sled behind her with surprising ease. She was a woman on a mission.
Let's go!
Nora shouted, pulling the tethered group along as she headed toward the perimeter of the illuminated circle.
I don't know what NASA's up to here, but I sure as hell don't appreciate being used as a pawn for their...
Nora Manger's neck snapped back as if she'd been rammed in the forehead by some invisible force. She let out a guttural gasp of pain, wavered, and collapsed backward onto the ice. Almost instantly, Corky let out a cry and spun around as if his shoulder had been propelled backward. He fell to the ice, writhing in pain. Rachel immediately forgot all about the printout in her hand, Ming, the meteorite, and the bizarre tunnel beneath the ice. She had just felt a small projectile graze her ear, barely missing her temple. Instinctively, she dropped to her knees, yanking Tallon down with her.
"What's going on?"
Tallon screamed. A hailstorm was all Rachel could imagine, balls of ice blowing down off the glacier. And yet from the force with which Corky and Nora had just been hit, Rachel knew the hailstones would have to be moving at hundreds of miles an hour. Eerily, the sudden barrage of marble-sized objects seemed now to focus on Rachel and Tolland, pelting all around them, sending up plumes of exploding ice. Rachel rolled onto her stomach, dug her crampons' toe spikes into the ice, and launched toward the only cover available, the sled. Tallon arrived a moment later, scrambling and hunkering down beside her. Tallon looked out at Nora and Corky, unprotected on the ice.
"Pull them in with a tether!"
he yelled, grabbing the rope and trying to pull. But the tether was wrapped around the sled. Rachel stuffed the printout in the Velcro pocket of her Mark IX suit and scrambled on all fours toward the sled, trying to untangle the rope from the sled runners. Tallon was right behind her. The hailstones suddenly rained down in a barrage against the sled, as if Mother Nature had abandoned Corky and Nora and was taking direct aim at Rachel and Tallon. One of the projectiles slammed into the top of the sled tarp, partially embedding itself, and then bounced over, landing on the sleeve of Rachel's coat. When Rachel saw it, she froze. In an instant, the bewilderment she had been feeling turned to terror. These hailstones were man-made. The ball of ice on her sleeve was a flawlessly shaped spheroid the size of a large cherry. The surface was polished and smooth, marred only by a linear seam around the circumference, like an old-fashioned lead musket ball machined in a press. The globular pellets were, without a doubt, man-made. Ice bullets. As someone with military clearance, Rachel was well acquainted with the new experimental IM weaponry, improvised munitions. Snow rifles that compacted snow into ice pellets. Desert rifles that melted sand into glass projectiles. Water-based firearms that shot pulses of liquid water with such force that they could break bones. Improvised munitions weaponry had an enormous advantage over conventional weapons because IM weapons used available resources and literally manufactured munitions on the spot, providing soldiers unlimited rounds without their having to carry heavy conventional bullets. The ice balls being fired at them now, Rachel knew, were being compressed on demand from snow fed into the butt of the rifle. As was often the case in the intelligence world, the more one knew, the more frightening a scenario became. This moment was no exception. Rachel would have preferred blissful ignorance, but her knowledge of IM weaponry instantly led her to a soul-chilling conclusion. They were being attacked by some kind of U.S. Special Ops force, the only forces in the country currently cleared to use these experimental IM weapons in the field. The presence of a military covert operations unit brought with it a second, even more terrifying realization. The probability of surviving this attack was close to zero. The morbid thought was terminated as one of the ice pellets found an opening and came screaming through the wall of gear on the sled, colliding with her stomach. Even in her padded Mark IX suit, Rachel felt like an invisible prize fighter had just gut-punched her. Stars began to dance around the periphery of her vision, and she teetered backward, grabbing gear on the sled for balance. Michael Tallon dropped Nora's tether and lunged to support Rachel, but he arrived too late. Rachel fell backward, pulling a pile of equipment with her. She and Tallon tumbled to the ice in a pile of electronic apparatus.
"They're bullets,"
she gasped, the air momentarily crushed from her lungs.
"Run!"
Chapter 50. The Washington Metro Rail subway, now leaving Federal Triangle Station, could not speed away from the White House fast enough for Gabrielle Ashe. She sat rigid in a deserted corner of the train as darkened shapes tore past outside in a blur. Marjorie Tench's big red envelope lay in Gabrielle's lap, pressing down like a 10-ton weight.
"I've got to talk to Sexton,"
she thought, the train accelerating now in the direction of Sexton's office building.
"Immediately."
Now, in the dim, shifting light of the train, Gabrielle felt like she was enduring some kind of hallucinogenic drug trip. Muted lights whipped by overhead like slow-motion discotheque strobes. The ponderous tunnel rose on all sides like a deepening canyon.
"Tell me this is not happening."
She gazed down at the envelope on her lap. Unclasping the flap, she reached inside and pulled out one of the photos. The internal lights of the train flickered for a moment, the harsh glare illuminating a shocking image. Sedgwick Sexton lying naked in his office, his gratified face turned perfectly toward the camera, while Gabrielle's dark form lay nude beside him. She shivered, rammed the photo back inside, and fumbled to reclasp the envelope.
"It's over."
As soon as the train exited the tunnel and climbed onto the above-ground tracks near L'Enfant Plaza, Gabrielle dug out her cell phone and called the senator's private cellular number. His voicemail answered. Puzzled, she phoned the senator's office. The secretary answered.
"It's Gabrielle. Is he in?"
The secretary sounded peeved.
"Where have you been? He was looking for you." "I had a meeting that ran long. I need to talk to him right away."
"You'll have to wait till morning. He's at Westbrook." Westbrook Place Luxury Apartments was the building where Sexton kept his D.C. residence.
"He's not picking up his private line,"
Gabrielle said.
"He blocked off tonight as a P.E.,
the secretary reminded.
"He left early."
Gabrielle scowled. Personal event. In all the excitement, she'd forgotten Sexton had scheduled himself a night alone at home. He was very particular about not being disturbed during his P.E. blocks.
"Bang on my door only if the building is on fire," he would say. "Other than that, it can wait until morning."
Gabrielle decided Sexton's building was definitely on fire.
"I need you to reach him for me."
"Impossible."
"This is serious. I really..."
"No, I mean literally impossible. He left his pager on my desk on his way out and told me he was not to be disturbed all night. He was adamant." She paused. "More so than usual."
"Shit. Okay, thanks."
Gabrielle hung up.
"L'Enfant Plaza," a recording announced in the subway car. "Connection all stations."
Closing her eyes, Gabrielle tried to clear her mind, but devastating images rushed in. The lurid photos of herself and the senator. The pile of documents alleging Sexton was taking bribes. Gabrielle could still hear Tench's raspy demands.
Do the right thing. Sign the affidavit. Admit the affair.
As the train screeched into the station, Gabrielle forced herself to imagine what the senator would do if the photos hit the presses. The first thing to pop in her mind both shocked and shamed her. Sexton would lie. Was this truly her first instinct regarding her candidate? Yes, he would lie. Brilliantly. If these photos hit the media without Gabrielle's having admitted the affair, the senator would simply claim the photos were a cruel forgery. This was the age of digital photo editing. Anyone who had ever been online had seen the flawlessly retouched spoof photographs of celebrities' heads digitally melded onto other people's bodies, often those of porn stars engaged in lewd acts. Gabrielle had already witnessed the senator's ability to look into a television camera and lie convincingly about their affair. She had no doubt he could persuade the world these photos were a lame attempt to derail his career. Sexton would lash out with indignant outrage, perhaps even insinuate that the president himself had ordered the forgery. No wonder the White House hasn't gone public. The photos, Gabrielle realized, could backfire just like the initial drudge. As vivid as the pictures seemed, they were totally inconclusive. Gabrielle felt a sudden surge of hope. The White House can't prove any of this is real. Tench's power play on Gabrielle had been ruthless in its simplicity. Admit your affair or watch Sexton go to jail. Suddenly it made perfect sense. The White House needed Gabrielle to admit the affair, or the photos were worthless. A sudden glimmer of confidence brightened her mood. As the train sat idling and the doors slid open, another distant door seemed to open in Gabrielle's mind, revealing an abrupt and heartening possibility. Maybe everything Tench told me about the bribery was a lie. After all, what had Gabrielle really seen? Yet again, nothing conclusive, some Xeroxed bank documents, a grainy photo of Sexton in a garage, all of it potentially counterfeit. Tench cunningly could have showed Gabrielle bogus financial records in the same sitting as the genuine sex photos, hoping Gabrielle would accept the entire package as true. It was called authentication by association, and politicians used it all the time to sell dubious concepts. Sexton is innocent, Gabrielle told herself. The White House was desperate, and they had decided to take a wild gamble on scaring Gabrielle into going public about the affair. They needed Gabrielle to desert Sexton publicly, scandalously. Get out while you can, Tench had told her. You have till 8 o'clock tonight. The ultimate pressure sales job. All of it fits, she thought. Except one thing. The only confusing piece of the puzzle was that Tench had been sending Gabrielle anti-NASA emails. This certainly suggested NASA really did want Sexton to solidify his anti-NASA stance so they could use it against him. Or did it? Gabrielle realized that even the emails had a perfectly logical explanation. What if the emails weren't really from Tench? It was possible Tench caught a traitor on staff sending Gabrielle data, fired that person, and then stepped in and emailed the final message herself, calling Gabrielle in for a meeting. Tench could have pretended she leaked all the NASA data on purpose to set Gabrielle up. The subway hydraulics hissed now in L'Enfant Plaza, the doors preparing to close. Gabrielle stared out at the platform, her mind racing. She had no idea if her suspicions were making any sense or if they were just wishful thinking, but whatever the hell was going on, she knew she had to talk to the senator right away, P.E. night or not. Clutching the envelope of photographs, Gabrielle hurried off the train just as the doors hissed shut. She had a new destination. Westbrook Place Apartments. Chapter 51. Fight or Flight. As a biologist, Tullin knew that vast physiological changes occurred when an organism sensed danger. Adrenaline flooded the cerebral cortex, jolting the heart rate and commanding the brain to make the oldest and most intuitive of all biological decisions, whether to do battle or flee. Tallinn's instinct told him to flee, and yet reason reminded him he was still tethered to Nora Manger. There was nowhere to flee, anyway. The only cover for miles was the Habisphere, and the attackers, whoever the hell they were, had positioned themselves high on the glacier and cut off that option. Behind him, the wide-open sheet of ice fanned out into a 2-mile-long plain that terminated in a sheer drop to a frigid sea. Flight in that direction meant death by exposure. The practical barriers to fleeing notwithstanding, Tallinn knew he could not possibly leave the others. Nora and Corky were still out in the open, tethered to Rachel and Tallinn. Tallinn stayed down near Rachel as the ice pellets continued to slam into the side of the toppled equipment sled. He pillaged the strewn contents, searching for a weapon, a flare gun, a radio, anything. "Run!" Rachel yelled, her breathing still strained. Then, oddly, the hailstorm of ice bullets abruptly stopped. Even in the pounding wind, the night felt suddenly calm, as if a storm had let up unexpectedly. It was then, peering cautiously around the sled, that Tallinn witnessed one of the most chilling sights he had ever seen. Gliding effortlessly out of the darkened perimeter into the light, three ghostly figures emerged, coasting silently in on skis. The figures wore full white weather suits. They carried no ski poles, but rather large rifles that looked like no guns Tallinn had ever seen. Their skis were bizarre as well, futuristic and short, more like elongated rollerblades than skis. Calmly, as if knowing they had already won this battle, the figures coasted to a stop beside their closest victim, the unconscious Nora Manger. Tallinn rose shakily to his knees and peered over the sled at the attackers. The visitors stared back at him through eerie electronic goggles. They were apparently uninterested, at least for the moment. Delta One felt no remorse as he stared down at the woman lying unconscious on the ice before him. He had been trained to carry out orders, not to question motives. The woman was wearing a thick black thermal suit and had a welt on the side of her face. Her breathing was short and labored. One of the IM ice rifles had found its mark and knocked her unconscious. Now it was time to finish the job. As Delta One knelt down beside the oblivious woman, his teammates trained their rifles on the other targets. One on the small unconscious man lying on the ice nearby, and one on the overturned sled where the two other victims were hiding. Although his men easily could have moved in to finish the job, the remaining three victims were unarmed and had nowhere to run. Rushing to finish them off all at once was careless. Never disperse your force unless absolutely necessary. Face one adversary at a time. Exactly as they had been trained, the Delta Force would kill these people one at a time. The magic, however, was that they would leave no trace to suggest how they had died. Crouched beside the unconscious woman, Delta One removed his thermal gloves and scooped up a handful of snow. Packing the snow, he opened the woman's mouth and began stuffing it down her throat. He filled her entire mouth, ramming the snow as deep as he could down her windpipe. She would be dead within 3 minutes. This technique, invented by the Russian mafia, was called the Baelia Smert, white death. This victim would suffocate long before the snow in her throat melted. Once dead, however, her body would stay warm long enough to dissolve the blockage. Even if foul play were suspected, no murder weapon or evidence of violence would be apparent immediately. Eventually, someone might figure it out, but it would buy them time. The ice bullets would fade into the environment, buried in the snow, and the welt on this woman's head would look as if she'd taken a nasty spill on the ice, not surprising in these gale-force winds. The other three people would be incapacitated and killed in much the same way. Then Delta One would load all of them on the sled, drag them several hundred yards off course, reattach their belay lines, and arrange the bodies. Hours from now, the four of them would be found frozen in the snow, apparent victims of overexposure and hypothermia. Those who discovered them would be puzzled by what they were doing off course, but nobody would be surprised that they were dead. After all, their flares had burned out, The weather was perilous, and getting lost on the Milne ice shelf could bring death in a hurry. Delta One had now finished packing snow down the woman's throat. Before turning his attention to the others, Delta One unhooked the woman's belay harness. He could reconnect it later, but at the moment, he didn't want the two people behind the sled getting ideas about pulling his victim to safety. Michael Tallon had just witnessed a murderous act more bizarre than his darkest mind could imagine. Having cut Nora Mangor free, the three attackers were turning their attention to Corky.
"I've got to do something."
Corky had come to and was moaning, trying to sit up. But one of the soldiers pushed him back down on his back, straddled him, and pinned Corky's arms to the ice by kneeling on them. Corky let out a cry of pain that was instantly swallowed up by the raging wind. In a kind of demented terror, Tallon tore through the scattered contents of the overturned sled. There must be something here, a weapon, something. All he saw was diagnostic ice gear, most of it smashed beyond recognition by the ice pellets. Beside him, Rachel groggily tried to sit up, using her ice axe to prop herself up.
"Run, Mike!"
Tallon eyed the axe that was strapped to Rachel's wrist. It could be a weapon, sort of. Tallon wondered what his chances were attacking three armed men with a tiny axe. Suicide. As Rachel rolled and sat up, Tallon spied something behind her. A bulky vinyl bag. Praying against fate that it contained a flare gun or radio, he clambered past her and grabbed the bag. Inside he found a large, neatly folded sheet of Mylar fabric. Worthless. Tallon had something similar on his research ship. It was a small weather balloon, designed to carry payloads of observational weather gear not much heavier than a personal computer. Nora's balloon would be no help here, particularly without a helium tank. With the growing sounds of Corky's struggle, Tallon felt a helpless sensation he had not felt in years. Total despair, total loss. Like the cliché of one's life passing before one's eyes before death, Tallon's mind flashed unexpectedly through long-forgotten childhood images. For an instant he was sailing in San Pedro, learning the age-old sailor's pastime of spinnaker flying. Hanging on a knotted rope, suspended over the ocean, plunging, laughing, into the water, rising and falling like a kid hanging on a belfry rope, his fate determined by a billowing spinnaker sail and the whim of the ocean breeze. Tallon's eyes instantly snapped back to the Mylar balloon in his hand, realizing that his mind had not been surrendering, but rather it had been trying to remind him of a solution. Spinnaker flying. Corky was still struggling against his captor as Tallon yanked open the protective bag around the balloon. Tallon had no illusions that his plan was anything other than a long shot, but he knew remaining here was certain death for all of them. He clutched the folded mass of Mylar. The payload clip warned, "Caution, not for use in winds over 10 knots. The hell with that. Gripping it hard to keep it from unfurling, Tallon clambered over to Rachel, who was propped on her side. He could see the confusion in her eyes as he nestled close, yelling, "Hold this!" Tallon handed Rachel the folded pad of fabric and then used his free hands to slip the balloon's payload clasp through one of the carabiners on his harness. Then, rolling on his side, he slipped the clasp through one of Rachel's carabiners as well. Tallon and Rachel were now one, joined at the hip. From between them, the loose tether trailed off across the snow to the struggling Corky, and 10 yards farther to the empty clip beside Nora Mangor. "Nora's already gone," Tallon told himself. "Nothing you can do." The attackers were crouched over Corky's writhing body now, packing a handful of snow and preparing to stuff it down Corky's throat. Tallon knew they were almost out of time. Tallon grabbed the folded balloon from Rachel. The fabric was as light as tissue paper and virtually indestructible. "Here goes nothing." "Hold on!"
"Mike!"
Rachel said.
"What?"
Tallon hurled the pad of wadded Mylar into the air over their heads. The howling wind snatched it up and spread it out like a parachute in a hurricane. The sheath filled instantly, billowing open with a loud snap. Tallon felt a wrenching yank on his harness, and he knew in an instant he had grossly underestimated the power of the katabatic wind. Within a fraction of a second, he and Rachel were half-airborne, being dragged down the glacier. A moment later, Tallon felt a jerk as his tether drew taut on Corky Marlinson. 20 yards back, his terrified friend was yanked out from under his stunned attackers, sending one of them tumbling backward. Corky let out a blood-curdling scream as he, too, accelerated across the ice, barely missing the overturned sled, then fishtailing inward. A second rope trailed limp beside Corky, the rope that had been connected to Nora Manger. "Nothing you can do," Tallon told himself. Like a tangled mass of human marionettes, the three bodies skimmed down the glacier. Ice pellets went sailing by, but Tallon knew the attackers had missed their chance. Behind him, the white-clad soldiers faded away, shrinking to illuminated specks in the glow of the flares. Tallon now felt the ice ripping beneath his padded suit with relentless acceleration, and the relief at having escaped faded fast. Less than 2 miles directly ahead of them, the Milne ice shelf came to an abrupt end at a precipitous cliff. And beyond it, 100-foot drop to the lethal, pounding surf of the Arctic Ocean. Chapter 52. Marjorie Tench was smiling as she made her way downstairs toward the White House communications office, the computerized broadcast facility that disseminated press releases formulated upstairs in the communications bullpen. The meeting with Gabrielle Ashe had gone well. Whether or not Gabrielle was scared enough to turn over an affidavit admitting the affair was uncertain, but it sure as hell was worth a try. Gabrielle would be smart to bail out on him, Tench thought. The poor girl had no idea just how hard Sexton was about to fall. In a few hours, the president's meteoric press conference was going to cut Sexton down at the knees. That was in the bank. Gabrielle Ashe, if she cooperated, would be the death blow that sent Sexton crawling off in shame. In the morning, Tench could release Gabrielle's affidavit to the press, along with footage of Sexton denying it. 1-2 punch. After all, politics was not just about winning the election. It was about winning decisively, having the momentum to carry out one's vision. Historically, any president who squeaked into office on a narrow margin accomplished much less. He was weakened right out of the gate, and Congress never seemed to let him forget it. Ideally, the destruction of Senator Sexton's campaign would be comprehensive, a two-pronged attack sacking both his politics and his ethics. This strategy, known in Washington as the high-low, was stolen from the art of military warfare. Force the enemy to battle on two fronts. When a candidate possessed a piece of negative information about his opponent, he often waited until he had a second piece and went public with both simultaneously. A double-edged attack was always more effective than a single shot, particularly when the dual attack incorporated separate aspects of his campaign. The first against his politics, the second against his character. Rebuttal of a political attack took logic, while rebuttal of a character attack took passion. Disputing both simultaneously was an almost impossible balancing act. Tonight, Senator Sexton would find himself scrambling to extract himself from the political nightmare of an astounding NASA triumph. And yet his plight would deepen considerably if he were forced to defend his NASA position while being called a liar by a prominent female member of his staff. Arriving now at the doorway of the communications office, Tench felt alive with the thrill of the fight. Politics was war. She took a deep breath and checked her watch. 6:15 p.m. The first shot was about to be fired. She entered. The communications office was small, not for lack of room, but for lack of necessity. It was one of the most efficient mass communications stations in the world, and employed a staff of only 5 people. At the moment, all 5 employees stood over their banks of electronic gear, looking like swimmers poised for the starting gun. "They are ready," Tench saw in their eager gazes. It always amazed her that this tiny office, given only 2 hours head start, could contact more than one-third of the world's civilized population. With electronic connections to literally tens of thousands of global news sources, from the largest television conglomerates to the smallest hometown newspapers, the White House Communications Office could,